This is an Irreverent podcast. Check out irreverent.fm for shows from all our friends.
This is NASCAR driver Tony Breidinger, inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for my favorite craveable chicken fingers. Turbocharge your order and get it even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app. Raising Cane's chicken fingers, one love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
What does motion sound like? With Kizikans free shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Hello and welcome to Exvangelical, a show exploring the world inside and outside the evangelical subculture. I'm your host, Blake Chastain. My guest today is Nick Rapatrazone. Nick is the author of a new book called Digital Communion, Marshall McLuhan's Vision for a Virtual Age. This interview is a bit of a rarity because I'm interviewing someone who hasn't spent much time in evangelical circles, but rather was raised and is a practicing Catholic. The reason I'm doing so is because, in another rarity, I'm talking to someone who also really enjoys the writing of Marshall McLuhan. Marshall McLuhan is considered by some to be sort of the prophet of the internet. He wrote books like Understanding Media and The Medium is the Massage in the 60s and 70s, and experienced a lot of popularity back then, and has been since rediscovered time and again by people who are fascinated with the effect that using media has on us. Books like The Medium is the Massage have a really prescient quality to them about how they sort of anticipated how things like using the internet would affect us as people. And what Nick's book brings to the fore is how much Marshall McLuhan's own understanding of the world through Christianity, as someone who was raised as a sort of in a sort of vague Protestant, evangelical or Christian space, and was a later convert to Catholicism, how that really affected the way that he viewed the world and affected the sorts of changes that he saw coming as a result of things like television and computers and what would eventually become the internet. It's a really fascinating conversation that goes a lot of various directions. Marshall McLuhan's own writing is sort of hodgepodge and filled with axioms and things that don't necessarily connect. And in that same manner, some of the questions that I ask of Nick do not really connect. There might not always be segues, and that is sort of in keeping with McLuhan's own writing and approach to discussions. We'll get to the interview with Nick in just a moment, but first I want to talk to you a little bit about how you can support the show directly. The first and best way you can do that is by subscribing to my publication, The Post-Evangelical Post. Exvangelical is a production of The Post-Evangelical Post, which is published over on Substack. You might be wondering why I chose Substack over something like Patreon, and really it's a whole bunch of various considerations, including the fact that I both write and conduct podcast interviews and things like that, and Substack is really just a more versatile tool for all of those different channels. In addition to that, there are things like being able to export member information and other information that is not available on Patreon or other things. And as a result, that's why I've chosen Substack. You can find out more about that over at postevangelicalpost.com. You can subscribe at $4, $6, or $8 a month, or sign up for free and get occasional updates as well. What will the membership get you? Well, first, you can receive ad-free podcast feeds to both Exvangelical and my other podcast, Powers and Principalities, as well as Discord access and access to subscriber-only writing. And that will be expanding in the later part of 2022 as well, once my book manuscript is done. In addition, I donate 25% of my net revenue each month to organizations that serve populations harmed by white evangelicalism. This is a type of individual reparations that I'm doing and trying to bake it directly into my business model. I understand that what I do does touch on some sensitive topics, but I also understand that I need to be able to at least cover my expenses and be able to have some financial return for the amount of time that I invest in this work as well. But doing it in within this manner to me is consistent with the overall values that I hold, as well as those that I work to aspire to. I have, as of right now, just under 70 paid subscribers to the Post Evangelical Post, and I would love to get that number closer to 100 within the next few months. If you do want to support me through Patreon, I do still have a sort of legacy Patreon that is available at patreon.com/exvangelicalpod, and I can opt you into this if you prefer that as a platform as well. If you want to support me via a one-time donation, you can also check the show notes for a Venmo link. I really appreciate you listening to this and listening to any of the interviews that I release. It's really valuable to me, and I hope it is valuable to you. If you want to learn about any other podcasts that are published by the Irreverent Media Group, head on over to irreverent.fm to learn about those shows as well. All right, let's get into it. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Exvangelical. My guest today is Nick Repatrizone. Nick is a writer for The Millions, culture editor for Image Journal, and author of the new book, Digital Communion, Marshall McLuhan's Vision for a Virtual Age. Nick, welcome to the show. Thank you for coming on. This is actually a rarity. I'm interviewing someone who, to my knowledge, didn't spend a lot of time in evangelical circles, but I'm doing so for a very good reason. We're here to talk about Marshall McLuhan. Megan O'Giblin, who I interviewed previously on this show, mentioned your then unpublished book about McLuhan, and that really piqued my interest. We'll get into how we both sort of came across Marshall McLuhan and his work. But before that, I would like to dive right in. And if you could talk a little bit about your relationship to Catholicism and how, and maybe even Christianity at large, and how you relate to that aspect of the world today.
Sure. Yeah, I am a cradle Catholic, which, you know, in our, I guess, nomenclature means, you know, born into the church, come from an Italian family, and have stayed in the church my whole life. My daughters go to Catholic school. My wife is Spanish and Ecuadorian, so this is like the World Cup of Catholicism kind of at this house right now. You know, it's a big part of our life. And as a writer, I have kind of jumped between Catholic/Christian publications and more secular places. I felt really comfortable going between the two, in part because I think it's important and healthy, both as a writer and a thinker, and maybe also as a person, to jump between those places. So growing up in New Jersey, which is a heavily Catholic place, it was never something that I really understood from the outside until I went to a Lutheran college in Pennsylvania. And it was my first time kind of outside of a Catholic space. And it was certainly instructive. But I, in my own writing and sort of in my own life, I'm just very much drawn to the story of Catholicism and the mystery, and of course the art and literature kind of keeps me there. So.
You mentioned just then that you weren't really exposed to Protestantism until college. I had the reverse, but I grew up in a very small town, Protestant town in Indiana. I only knew one Catholic family, and then we moved to the suburbs of Chicago, which is much higher representation of Catholicism. So that sort of experience of seeing the other side of, there's other Orthodox traditions and other things, but between the two, Catholicism and the 500 years of Protestantism, especially within the American context, are the two largest. Thank you for sharing that. I really appreciate it. Let's talk about a different type of encounter, which is a literary encounter. When did you first learn about Marshall McLuhan, and what was the sort of context? And maybe even if you could share for the listener who's not familiar with who Marshall McLuhan is, maybe a little bit. We'll obviously be spending most of our conversation talking about his biography as well as his thinking and work. But let's start there with just where you first came across McLuhan, and if you, after that, just a little bit about McLuhan to ground the conversation.
Sure. Yeah, McLuhan was someone really as an undergrad that I first was introduced to, sort of tangentially in a course on Thomas Pynchon, Don DeLillo, postmodern American writers, who also happened to be Catholics. And the professor was a professor who was from, he got his doctorate from UCLA and came to us in Pennsylvania from the West Coast, and really gave me a new perspective on what was happening in the 60s, 70s, and 80s in American literature. And McLuhan kind of snuck his way into some conversations, but I really didn't know much about him beyond kind of the aphoristic taglines, the sort of stuff that a lot of people have heard of. Medium is a Message, Global Village, which are actually pretty complicated and paradoxical concepts, but sort of are pop and culture, I guess, in their nature. So I didn't dig much into him as an undergrad beyond that initial introduction. But in the past 10 years or so, when I start to realize the kind of religious underpinning of his work and how deeply religious he was, and at the same time, sort of this pop culture phenomenon, I'm always interested in sort of pop culture Catholics. I think there's sort of a unique, at the moment, popular Catholic presence. I mean, when I try to explain to people that Stephen Colbert, Lady Gaga, like these are pop culture Catholics who are deeply Catholic in their sensibility and who see kind of the tension between like the personal self and the pop self kind of as generative, then it helps me think of McLuhan from that earlier generation.
Could you elaborate on that a little bit? Because I think that would be really instructive for this particular audience, because it is primarily evangelical and has a relationship that is very different than perhaps the Catholic one. So it might be a study of contrast there. As far as what you said about that pop, you know, pop and personal self.
Yeah. So my kind of personal Catholicism is heavily influenced by what are known as the Jesuits, the Society of Jesus. And it's you know, Georgetown, Loyola, Boston College, like a lot of colleges have an affiliation with the Jesuits. And the Jesuits they're highly intellectual and art driven. So for me, Catholicism and faith have always been inextricable from storytelling, expression, art, paradox, sometimes uncomfortable tensions, you know, those sort of things. So I'm like definitely an Andy Warhol kind of Catholic in that sense. And, you know, so Andy Warhol for me was like the entry point to something called pop Catholicism, where you have an incredibly well-known artist or writer or performer who is very much in the secular world and comfortable with it, but also in the Catholic mystical tradition. And they don't see those two things as being mutually exclusive. They actually find them to be the synthesis there. They're generative. So even someone like Stephen Colbert, who is, I believe, was a Sunday school teacher in New Jersey up until recently, who's a deeply Catholic person and is a satirist and a performer and a comedian, who has these moments of great religious introspection on his show that are sort of unheard of in contemporary American entertainment. And they're not always patently Catholic, but they are certainly Christian and they're faith-filled. So for me, I see in them this kind of unique way to approach the public self as being anchored in this maybe esoteric, mystical Catholic practice and sensibility. And for, you know, it might not be true for all Catholics, but certainly the Catholicism that I come from and subscribe to find those two things as working well together.
Thank you. Thank you for, and McLuhan in particular was a, a later in life, well, at least in college age and around that time, he was a convert. He was raised, you have a quote that he described his upbringing as loosely Protestant. But then it was more of an intellectual and academic engagement with some other Catholic thinkers that drew him to Catholicism to begin with, correct?
Yeah. Yeah, as you're right. His mom wasn't very happy when he told her via letters that he was thinking of going over to the Papists. And she was a little miffed at that. And he was, as you note, quite influenced by other Catholic converts. Gerard Manley Hopkins, the Jesuit poet, was sort of a defining light for him. And Hopkins' mom also wasn't too happy, so there's kind of a connection there. But, you know, Hopkins was an incredible poetic stylist, probably one of the most influential and innovative writers ever, I think, in his prosody and his poetry. And McLuhan was fascinated by him, and he saw in him a Catholic writer who broke with orthodoxy and did things that were quite progressive stylistically as a writer for his time. And while McLuhan was also interested in Chesterton, and I think Chesterton was formative, McLuhan was especially drawn to James Joyce, who is, I mean, for me, the most Catholic writer ever, but for others maybe who are more skeptical, they think that his lapsed Catholic, which is somebody who sort of left the church, disengages him. But for me, you know, and certainly in listening to, you know, your show and hearing you talk about this, it's, you know, the distance doesn't mean necessarily separation, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, I think Joyce was someone that McLuhan thought was Catholic to the core, and its paradoxes really anchored his quite fantastic writing.
I want to pick out a couple of different things that you point out in the book. One is something you already touched on, which is that, and I think it may be a difference between some types of Catholicism and some types of fundamentalist evangelicalism, which can be anti-intellectual. You write that rather than an intellectual vice, belief charged the Catholic thinker. And I apologize, I can't remember if that was if you were making a quote or if that was your writing. But that seems to be what animated McLuhan and what also may have drawn you to the same sort of work and literature that you study now.
Yeah, because I think that, I mean, my interest has been, I guess it's a mixture of like coming from immigrant family, both myself and my wife. So there's like that folk kind of piety, and, you know, our house is full of like Virgin Mary statues and, you know, crucifixes and rosaries. Like my daughters have a rosary collection. Like it's, you know, you've got like that folk kind of piety, but it's also juxtaposed with the Jesuit inclination towards being in the world, that it's not monastic, contemplative. It is part of everyday secular life. So I'm, for the past 18 years, I've been a public school teacher of English. I work all day long with people, you know, young kids in a secular setting. We talk about McLuhan, talk about Toni Morrison, talk about, you know, all kinds of stuff like that. But it's, you know, so my life as a teacher, as a writer, is in those spaces. So I think for Jesuit inclined Catholics, Catholicism is a place of open inquiry. And also, I would use the word strangeness, and I use that word in a kind of positive way for art. I think art and religion at their best are really weird, and that's sort of good, you know, like it's unusual. It's supposed to be supernatural, like in the truest sense of the word. It transcends the material. So for McLuhan, who was really trained as a scholar of literature, you know, his PhD at Cambridge was on the satirist Thomas Nashe, who was a really kind of, I guess, dirty is the right word. Like he just wrote some crazy stuff. And you know, to see like McLuhan, who was this very kind of like formal fellow and studying this guy who wrote, he would talk, Thomas Nashe would talk about prostituting himself via his pen. Like he was, he would go out there in sort of wild places. And but McLuhan thought that satirists and people who made puns and people who were comedic, like James Joyce, pushed the borders of language, that they gave it, they allowed it to stretch. And for a Catholic, I mean, this is not exclusive to Catholicism for sure, but for a Catholic, at least in McLuhan's time, that meant going to Mass in Latin. So they'd go to church and the priest would be talking in another language, not the language you talk at your kitchen table or in school. And that made it weird. It made it strange and it made it memorable and theatrical. And that all works together with the intellect and the smells and bells, as they say, and it becomes something else.
And was it the way in which McLuhan was attuned to those environmental things, both the environmental aspects of a traditional Catholic Mass, as well as this literary training that he has, that makes him so tuned in to perceiving and starting to notice the sort of the shifts in. He was writing in the 50s and 60s through the 70s, and I'm a geriatric millennial. So, like, I briefly remember a time before computers and things like that. But at the same time, that was also a period of considerable media upheaval. So how did those two things start to, like, intersect in his work and what he started to comment on and study? Because he, as you mentioned, he was trained as a literature professor, but then started this, helped contribute to the beginnings of what is now media studies.
Yeah, I like your usage of the word perceiving or perception, because I think that is the key. His first book was A Mechanical Bride, and I think it was published in 1951. It's this really kind of odd little book where he picked out print advertisements and studied them so closely that it almost reaches the point of parody. Like, he reads into the layout of a jewelry ad, or like a woman standing in a sort of like a fashion magazine, and he just like so goes for it. And it seems like he's having a lot of fun while he's doing it. Like, he's cracking jokes and stuff. And he realized that it was the wrong book for him to be writing, that he was writing of the mechanical world, which was really on its way out. And he was fond of the word obsolescence, which means a little bit different than something that's obsolete. So it's not like the world that he was talking about was fully gone, but it was about to be. So when you have a time like that, and as you describe sort of within your own life, there has been those obsolescence moments, you know, moving towards the digital world from the analog. Those are like the richest moments where we can really see what's at the heart of communication. So McLuhan went from The Mechanical Bride to looking at the ways in which our media transform the environment of our life. So his Gutenberg Galaxy, understanding media, and then leading to kind of like his high points of the mid 60s and the 70s. As you say, he fully became a media critic, and he was a critic and a participant. Everywhere that you would look, Marshall McLuhan was. In every magazine that you could imagine, Vogue magazine had a feature on him and just let him write like 2,000 words on his esoteric kind of view of the world. He had this incredible Playboy interview. It's one of my favorites of his. He was, I think New York Times did like 20 something stories on him in 1967 alone. Like, people loved him, and he was on TV, and he was, Goldie Hawn had a tagline about him on her Laughing show, and Yoko Ono and John Lennon interviewed him. Like, it's the weirdest like mixture of, I mean, he was a superstar, but at the same time, he was this older Canadian professor of literature at like a Warhol kind of pop show. Like, he was so out of place, but that's perfect, because I mean, we're all out of place in our own ways, and he just realized the power in that. And that allowed him to be, as you mentioned before, his ability to perceive was sharp, and he tended to not really make value judgments. He just looked and documented and wrote it down and inhabited those worlds. And that's what gave him a prophetic touch that other people haven't really been able to catch.
Yeah. And in my own sort of, so where I learned about McLuhan, oddly enough, was within the context of a class called Western Intellectual and Social History, and it was taught by what I now can name as like a Christian Reconstructionist professor. Very different type of environment to learn about someone like McLuhan, but even that professor, who definitely had a very particular agenda with the type of understanding that he wanted to instill. I remember being assigned understanding media and not really understanding it. But then rediscovering some of his other work later. And it is definitely, he wrote and spoke in axioms. Like you mentioned, the medium is the message. A printing error led to the medium is the massage, which he thought was hilarious, and he ran with it. And that was one of his most famous books, with an incredible typographic design by his collaborator, Quentin Fiore. And I'd love to even sort of McLuhan-type style, before we keep digging into some of the other parts of your book, talk about some of the sort of prescience of a lot of some of those statements. One of them, let's start with the medium as the message. You mentioned like that is a deceptively simple statement, but I think maybe even within our social media climate now, it really rings true. It doesn't matter what is said as long as you keep tweeting and posting.
I like that you brought up our contemporary kind of equivalent. I think in that phrase, the medium is the message, its simplicity is true, like the, I guess, simple interpretation of it. And then the more complex McLuhan intention is simultaneously also true. So I think he had an elasticity to his metaphors that allowed him to kind of reach multiple audiences. A lot of people, when they talk about the medium as a message, they kind of render it as, if you text someone, it's not so much what the content of the text is, which probably most of our texts are, forgettable at some point. It's the fact that you're texting someone. That's the true thing that's interesting. And what McLuhan, who had to certainly explain this himself, because, he found, he would be the first to admit that he was confusing as hell, sort of, and he's all right with that, So, so what he explained was that he said that the medium as a message means that when we, whatever medium or media that we use, it's the effect on us and our environment via that. So it is true that it's not important, the content of the text that I send, but what is important, that I'm using a non-audio manner of communication, and I'm using its own language. I'm using my fingers. I'm not using a keypad in the sense of like a computer. I'm using a handheld device. I'm probably dashing it off like between classes or, in a rush. It's the surrounding environment that creates the true message and true experience. So when we think of it that way, and I think of Twitter, I think you mentioned Twitter before, which I'm fascinated by, reviled by simultaneously. It's the weirdest like space of my life, I would say. And whenever I think of Twitter, I think of in a spatial sense, like this long tunnel with a lot of lights on all sides and a lot of like wailing and gnashing of teeth, sort of like, it's just a really loud place and a fast place. And I think if we follow McLuhan's vision, it's healthy to ask ourselves, what has that done to our conception of language and communication, building of our own identity, reception of other people's identities? It's done a lot. And I think that the medium is a message, as you say, is the most sort of popular McLuhanism, and yet it makes so much sense with that idea of the transformation of the environment. It really, really holds true.
Yeah. One of the other things he writes in The Medium is the Massage, and I'm sure in other places as well, is this idea that environments are invisible. And even that in and of itself is not something we always think of. And again, I am thinking of it within that sort of contemporary context of the way in which, especially since the pandemic and lingering effects of that, as well as the uncertainty that we all sort of face here in the United States and elsewhere in the world surrounding COVID safety, our reliance on those things is is not going away. The other one that I feel dovetails into this and is the phrase, first we shape our tools and thereafter our tools shape us. So how do you, again, with engaging with McLuhan's thinking there, how do you see that playing out for us today?
Yeah, what social media has offered us is another mode of communication, which we've always desired multiple modes of communication in life, you know, going from oral to written to performative. And what it's done is it's given us immediate and eternal accessibility and expectation of accessibility. And there's nowhere to hide, really, at this point. Because if you do hide, someone will wonder why you're hiding. And if you never got it in the first place, they'll also wonder why you're not there. So you have to be there in a way. So you have to be eternally present. And it's so hard to explain that to someone who never experienced a world before that. So, you know, I mean, the best that I can remember is getting the AOL like CD in the mail and the dial-up screaming of getting on the internet and my sister not being able to use her phone and telling me get off. So like even in that negotiation of space and time, there was a recognition that there was a separation between those worlds, that if she was going to talk on the phone, I wasn't going to be online. But now there's no more separation. Of course, we don't need to have it. So we're constantly connected. And then if we follow McLuhan's idea of sort of the media being extension of our nervous systems, or these devices being extensions of ourselves, the ubiquity of these observations doesn't lessen like their efficacy. Like to say that a phone is an extension of ourself, and we've all heard that a million times, but it is an extension of ourself. I mean, it's on my desk. I don't know why right now. There's no function for it. It's turned over, but it's there. And then when I go down the hallway, it's going to come with me. And I mean, that's McLuhan's fear. I mean, he was nervous that we would be taken over by these things. And I don't know how to turn it around. And I don't know what the next step is. It's a tough thing to get out of once you're in.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. One of the other insights that he had that you discuss in the book is that, as you mentioned, digital electric media is an extension of our nervous system, which I think is why a lot of us, you know, if we get, you know, sucked in, or whether you want to use words like addicted or whatever, or you just use social media, or you get in a flame war online, you just feel stretched thin. Like I think of like the early scenes of Fellowship of the Ring where Bilbo's talking about feeling like butter scraped over too much bread. You know, that's sort of how it feels sometimes if you're online, if you're extremely online. And another sort of thing that McLuhan perceived was that Electric Man has no bodily being. He is literally discarnate. And to bring it back a bit to how his Catholicism informed these types of insights, how did this process of converting to Catholicism, continuing? Another thing that he mentioned is that he wanted to convert perceptively instead of religiously. So like with those things in mind, how did his Catholicism inform his insight into media and everything else?
Sure. Yeah. The Second Vatican Council, about 1962, 1965, was a really defining moment in the worldwide Catholic Church, but especially in the American Catholic Church, as a time for the Church to kind of reconsider its role with modernity. Like, was it going to play by the secular rules, but still retain its anchoring in tradition? Or was it, I mean, what was it going to do? And McLuhan was rather traditionalist. He, and this is not unusual for converts to Catholicism, even to this day. So he noticed that in Catholic Mass, there was an increasing usage of microphones. And it made sense because, you know, you get the people at the back of the church and they can barely hear what's going on. But he noticed that when you spoke Latin into a microphone, that it sounded like a garbled kind of mess. Like it was just unintelligible. And your average Catholic in the pews isn't a scholar of Latin in 1955 or whatever, but they know Mass Latin. And what happened was he wrote a series of articles saying that this was going to be sort of the death of the liturgy. And what happened soon after that is that church was done in the vernacular, so English in America, and Latin was, for the most part, not celebrated. And McLuhan thought that was a terrible decision. And part of the reason was that he found Latin to be mystical, that it was transformative, that it was unusual, that it was old. And in its archaic nature, the second you walked into that church, it became another acoustic space. So he was a big believer in kind of acoustic experience. And, you know, to go back to what you're saying in terms of how this conversion sort of affected him, he wanted to hold on to those old traditions of the church in a time where the world was changing rapidly. And I don't think McLuhan ever thought himself that he could stop the world from changing, nor did he think he should, but he wanted people to be aware of those changes and to be reflective on them and to ask themselves what it meant. And so, for example, television became his kind of ultimate medium when he moved on from that print work of his earlier career. And what McLuhan liked was that no matter what, whether the television content was good or bad, like you had a family sitting together in a room and there was this moment of like communal experience. And he thought there was something powerful in that. And, you know, whether or not we've lost it recently, I don't know. But when it comes to the digital kind of element of this, of course, McLuhan, he died in 1980 and he didn't really live to see much of the things that we're experiencing in any way. But he did recognize, he was, I think, a futurist, especially towards the end of his career. And when you talk about this disembodied, disincarnate self, if we completely give over to the metaverse, so to speak, ethics start to fall apart, I think, in a traditional way, in a way that protects us. And for McLuhan, the flesh was necessary and the physicality of this world was necessary to ground us. It's hard to remember that the people with whom we disagree online have physical corporeal forms, you know, that they're hungry, that they're sad, that they go to sleep at night. Like, it helps to remember those things when we dislike people. Doesn't mean we love them, but, you know, it just helps. And McLuhan's nightmare would be that we lose that completely.
And just to go down that sort of tangent a little bit, do you see that playing out as far as within the next? These are the sort of things that worry me or like occupy at least part of my mind as a parent, is like, whether it's augmented reality or virtual reality, what are the norms going to be for my child's generation of how they use these things? And also, you know, my own place and contribution to them as well. But that is sort of the leading concern. The fact that augmented reality could be a potential way that, even though it's a mediated experience, it has its own dangers of applying prejudiced filters on reality itself. Would that be preferable either to McLuhan or to us compared to just me being, and all of us being, in a room jacked into a computer and not having simulated, being fully simulated and not having this embodied experience?
I think a lot of these creations, you know, there's this moment of rawness and freedom and turmoil at the start. And I think we're still kind of in that space where there's innovation and there's risk and there's unhealthy things that happen. And then sooner or later, someone has to anchor them in some sort of ethics. And that process probably is not best done via the companies who provide those things to us. You know, so
that is an understatement.
Yeah. So, you know, the question is, well, where does it come from? And I don't know what the best arbiter of that is, but I'm a big proponent of, I believe that digital literacy should be a course, multiple courses in one's high school experience and one's college experience. I think the assumption that the widespread participation of people online prepares them to be online doesn't work, because, I mean, we know as adults, there was no preparation for this. It just sort of happened. And I remember like the AOL days not being prepared for it. Instant Messenger days not being prepared for it. Like there was never, we were never made ready for it. And then those things were ancient compared to what we're using now. Right.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
So if we're on this sort of highway and we are just like thrown on it, when no one taught us how to drive, it's a mess. When you bring up kids, you know, I think McLuhan would feel that the ultimate problem is the lack of feeling that you're worth something, sort of. I mean, he would have a religious spin on it, of course, but you know, the idea that if we don't believe that we're worth anything, then the way that we treat others and the way that we are treated online can go downhill really quickly. But if we think that we're worth something and the people that we interact with are worth something, then that's where the ethics can find its footing. So we better figure it out soon because, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely agree that entrusting those types of deep ethical questions to the corporations that benefit mightily from our use of them is not the right move. Like, there's definitely some fascinating things in, like, Shannon Valor's book, Technology and the Virtues, is a really good exploration of technomoral virtues is what she calls them, which is just fascinating. And the only other things I can think of are actually parallels in fiction that authors have done, like Werner Vinge's Rainbow's End, which is largely about, the plot is largely sort of a stranger in a strange land of a Alzheimer's patient who sort of hits the medical lottery and then has the body of a young person again, but has to go to a vocational school in order to learn how to use augmented reality type internet. So I like for there to be some secular version of like a small catechism for digital life is not the worst idea. Like it could certainly be administered by public schools or any type of thing, but I agree. Thank you for going down that going down that particular lane with me. I do want to backtrack and talk about one thing in particular about some of his statements about the printing press and sort of how and about literacy and one of his sort of beliefs you mentioned earlier that he was a proponent of auditory experience, of acoustic space. And a lot of, if you go onto Spotify, you can actually find the album, The Medium is the Massage. And he talks about, you know, in that it's basically a performance version of his book. And he contrasts the sort of the linear aspect of writing, of printed writing, versus the sort of more scattershot world of the ear. But one of the things that stood out to me, and maybe this is my own background, he said, you quote him as writing, that the new homogeneity of the printed page seemed to inspire a subliminal faith in the validity of the printed Bible as bypassing the traditional authority of the church, and essentially that the nature of the mass-produced Bible had the power of creating a new hypnotic superstition of the book as independent of and uncontaminated by human agency. That seems to me to sort of imply very heavily that the doctrine of inerrancy in a lot of fundamentalist strains of Christianity may not have been possible without the printing press. Do you think that that's like a valid, that sort of stuck out to me while reading the book because a lot of our lawmakers believe that, and it literally guides policy in our country. So it still has relevancy for us. Is that a fair reading of what McLuhan is sort of saying about the impact of print itself?
I think so. I think McLuhan, Gutenberg, of course, based on the title of that book, but also the interspersed kind of description of the press and his other works, you know, it was really important to McLuhan in terms of, as you say, like this paradigm shifting moment where it seemed to have been not mere happenstance that the printed word and biblical texts, Psalters, missals, hymnals, you know, these things kind of went hand in hand. McLuhan was, for all of his, I guess, conservative predilections, was very much a non-literalist reader of scripture. You know, he was talking about how the Catholic Church was built on the pun of Peter Stone, you know, the rock upon my church. So he liked when language sort of played around a little bit. I think when you talk about inerrancy, when you talk about mass production, when you talk about a text that went from scribes and scholars, people with a deep understanding of it, to being able to be reproduced by anyone at any time in any version that one wanted, it then creates this weird kind of democratization of the sacred, which is both sometimes good, of course, but also in this instance can be quite problematic. I think McLuhan was nervous about the fact that, he argued in Gutenberg Galaxy and elsewhere that individuality went away with the print world in many forms, that we became this kind of uniform self, collective self, that he thought was an issue. And that only when we got back to not exactly a primitive storytelling, but maybe more oral inclined storytelling, a personable storytelling, that we can reclaim kind of that individuality. I mean, when McLuhan converted, he was reading the Bible, the Church Fathers, quite heavily. So he was, I think his son might have said that he was the most well-read Bible knowledge. I mean, he had the best knowledge of the Bible of anyone he ever met. So for McLuhan, the concept of the Bible as a book or the book was a useful metaphor. And in Catholicism, because that's really the only perception I have, biblical exegesis, literary modes of the Bible, are something that is commonly spoken about, that it is seen as a text that is incredibly complicated and something that is handled via scholarship, like that there's a deep scholarly tradition of this book, which I think I'm inferring from the way that you're talking about it in other traditions, that might not always be true.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there is definitely an element of personal interpretation. And there is also, but other groups, especially within different parts of evangelicalism, which is my bailiwick, they create their own method of developing that authority. But it is generally done with a number of assumptions underlying it. One of the major ones is, especially since, you know, the reaction against German high criticism going all the way back to like the late 19th century, early 20th century is the belief in the inerrancy in the inerrancy of the biblical text, that there is no error, and it's a completely ideological stance. So, but yes, that is definitely present in many parts of evangelicalism, is the belief in the inerrancy, and that if it is not inerrant, then all these other things are dependent upon it, which makes faith crises or going to college and learning about these things suspect to being damaging to one's faith.
Yeah.
It's definitely not a simple thing, but the way in which McLuhan in particular has a way of shining a light on how different technological modes affect religiosity and how religious authority, like literal authority and other and influence, sort of goes along with literacy, both in the scribal period following into print and even today. So it's definitely fascinating. Do you think that we have sort of arrived at McLuhan's vision of the global village, like with our sort of social media environment being what it is, very cacophonous, lots of voices, very difficult to discern. There's still the presence of a lot of these legacy media spaces, and they still have a lot of capital, but they're not the only players anymore. Do you think that we've sort of stepped into McLuhan's world.
Yeah, because I think the Global Village for him was a really bad place. He once referred to it as an Ann Landers column writ large, which is, I don't know if people know what Ann Landers or who she was anymore, but like this idea of judgment and gossip, like being made public, and the idea that when we know more about each other and we know we're more in tune with one's daily actions as we are online with updates and retweets, favorites, and so on, that the more we're going to dislike each other and find discord, that it's inevitable. And so the Global Village for him in a utopian vision could be good, if only because it forced us to recognize that experience could be simultaneously had by someone as we are right now, you know, geographically pretty far from each other. But the issue for McLuhan, who definitely in his religious vision of this was nervous it would be manipulated against us, that he ultimately thought the, you know, tendency, for example, of people to fight on Twitter, why would it surprise any of us? You know, given the kind of the flamethrowers and we're in like that endless tunnel and there's no air, that we're going to fight sooner or later. And what McLuhan and people who have interpreted McLuhan have tried to, I guess, in the optimistic sense, think of is, so in what way could we make this better? And in what way could we be online together, electronically connected, participating in each other's lives in sometimes incredibly deep ways? How do you make that healthy? I don't know, because I think, you know, if I think of like a day on Twitter, someone will share a ridiculous kind of joke and also say what they're really deeply feeling in the next tweet. So why is this medium the place for both of those things? Why don't other media in their life offer them that avenue? You know, so if this was 1950, 1960 in McLuhan's time, and you wanted to tell a joke or you wanted to say like your existential crisis moment, where would that information go? Well, I guess it would go in a journal, in a phone call, in a conversation with family member, friend. Only newspaper writers and performers would project it to the public. So we've all become celebrities, faux celebrities, in the sense that, you know, anyone could find our information. So we're performers, but we don't know who the audience is. We're unpaid for our performances, but they're deeply personal. It's the mess. And, you know, as you mentioned before, it's tough for adults. And then for someone who's like 14, it must be impossible and could be soul crushing at some level. And because McLuhan didn't live to see it, you know, we don't ultimately know his escape method, but I think his interpretation of the electronic coming world at least shows us that the self-awareness has to be there and the acknowledgement of the changing of the environment has to be there, and the recognition that just because we can access these places and participate in these spaces doesn't mean we have to always, that we can kind of turn away from them if we need to.
Did you feel that way while you're writing the book, that you had to turn away from these things? Because I'm in the process of working on a book right now, and like, even though I'm writing very much about the internet, I'm reading about the internet. I can't be on the internet while I do that. And I just think that's such a, like, I don't know if that's true. Like, if I was writing a book about libraries, I could go to a library, you know? But I can't be online and write about being online. Does that make sense?
it does, because it's possible. Well, it's possible that you're engaging it in a way that you hadn't previously, or you're perceiving it in a way you haven't previously, or you're reconsidering assumptions which have forced you to reconsider the presentation of the self and the investment. You know, every tweet, however stupid it might be, is a text offered to an audience. And as writers, you know, whether people are writers for publication or writers for their own, you know, in a narrative journaling sense or diary sense, it matters how people receive it. So if that becomes like the way in which we communicate, where we tweet something inane or meaningful or whatever, and then we're sort of just waiting for the response, like what happens to the rest of life in that interim? So for me, writing this book, I never really went offline, because every time I have tweeted doing that, I'm back in like 7 hours, just because it's like impossible to not be. But I did find myself just having kind of like a bad taste about it all, I guess you can say. Like it just felt, I just wondered why we've given into it so wholeheartedly.
Yeah. Yeah. And that seems to, that sort of side-eyeing it all, like it's become almost an entire genre, right? Like from The Social Dilemma, featuring, you know, product designers and managers that literally created the mechanisms, to all sorts of books, whether it's books about digital literacy, like Reader Come Home, or The Shallows. Like, yeah, we're all sort of, maybe I'm feeling very, like I'm just vibing with that. And I can't believe I just said that, but you know, I'm on that same wavelength. Mm-hmm. I feel like I'm too old to say vibing, but, but it definitely seems to be like, maybe it's just a level of mass exhaustion with it. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure.
If we've been so invested in it, especially in the last few years, mm-hmm. by a need to be, and no, it is exhausting. And I think that's part of the thing that you bring up, and also that societally we have to reckon with, is that the kinesthetic experience of being in front of the screen is a very tiring thing. And the amount of texts that we create online via tweets or posts is a high amount of text and narrative and persona and performance and all those things. And they take a lot out of people, and in a spiritual sense can be tremendously exhausting.
And these things are becoming ways. And I mean, this show is an extension of that. I'm not unaware of that. New media has always allowed people to explore new avenues of spirituality, religious thought, religious practice. And that's definitely seeming to happen now. There's, you know, there is an idea, the sort of mechanical or print world was actually the Gutenberg parenthesis, that was the exception. It's like mm-hmm. a 500 year mm-hmm. exception. Yeah. And then we're sort of back to where we were, but with new things. But it's really, these are the sort of things that I think McLuhan, a lot of his texts are sort of provocations. You know, they're things to make you think. And I find that really valuable. And near the end of your book, you talk about how by the end of his life, he had sort of faded. He had some health challenges and was no longer in the public eye. But then his work has had legs. You know, it continues to find fans, continues to find people. One of them being, you mentioned Kevin Kelly, who is one of the founding editors of Wired. He wrote a book called What Technology Wants, which sort of dovetails with this idea that explores the idea that that technology has its own, almost its own will, and should be considered like an eighth animal kingdom almost. The technium is what he calls it. Within that context of sort of the legacy, and starting with Kelly, and like, is there the vision beyond sort of the pessimistic vision of the global village that we live in now? Is there another side of McLuhan's religious vision that does sort of, if not optimistic, maybe pragmatic or hopeful? Maybe let's land on hopeful, like a hopeful vision of where we're going with the media that we create and what the society and religions and beliefs that those allow. Is there a hopeful bent to some of his vision too?
Yeah, I do think so. I think every time that my family watched virtual mass in 2020, 2021, we were in McLuhan's best possible vision of this kind of the sacramental encounter from a distance when it was impossible to do otherwise. I think that he forces us to think, at least in the Catholic Church, about what sacraments really are, what if we believe in an incarnate vision of the world, if Christ is everywhere, why wouldn't he be online, like in the internet? Like, why wouldn't it be there? Why is that a place that is closed to him? So I think, I mean, certainly in terms of accessibility and reaching people for whom going to church is not physically possible or not physically advantageous, it opened up this option that I'm hoping people involved with the church and ministry will pursue. You know, I've heard from both ends of the spectrum. I've heard from people who want to get them back in the church physically as fast as they can. And I'm not immune to their financial concerns. But I also think that there was something almost magical about, I mean, this is like that image of Pope Francis in the square, that famous picture of him in like 2020, where he's almost alone in that wide open abandoned space. And it was, we weren't physically with him, but we were experiencing it at the same time when we saw him. And that unites people. So I think one of the tricky things with religion is that sometimes religious people want to be supernatural, but only to a point. Like, they don't want to go too far, because then, but to me, like if you're going to buy the big story, those other supernatural stories kind of connected to that. And an incarnational vision of the world, for me, goes pretty well with a digital vision done right. It's another extension of the physical. It's another extension of the mind. And you know, when Kevin Kelly and others at Wired chose McLuhan as their patron saint, you know, putting him on the masthead of the magazine, writing articles about him in early issues, these were all, I mean, Kelly at that time, he grew up Catholic, and some of the other editors were still Catholic. They knew what they were doing. They were pointing towards a guy who was spiritual and religious and Eucharistic in his vision of what media could be. So for me, we shouldn't just kind of give up and give in, I guess. So I tend to not be as pessimistic as McLuhan at his most pessimistic. I just want the self-awareness to be present for people, because I think it's very easy to not be self-aware online and to have it go badly quickly. But it doesn't have to be that way. I mean, it really doesn't. And I know it's hard for, you know, to make it the other way, but you know, it's worth it.
Right, right. Well, I really appreciated this book just because it did wrestle with these things that like really go together. I know, and like maybe people don't think of these things as going together as sort of religious or spiritual or philosophical pursuit of understanding and also understanding how we, but maybe now that's not as much of a leap, because we all do mediate everything through major platforms and devices. And but the way that this book frames things, I think is really fascinating and shed a new light on McLuhan's background. The only other biography I'd really read is You Know Nothing of My Work by Douglas Copeland, which was definitely interesting, definitely a different type of approach. But to approach McLuhan's religious and spiritual understanding of the world as central and essential to his work that he developed was really fascinating, and I'll definitely carry that with me. Thank you for talking with me about this and sort of going whichever way the conversation would wind, which felt appropriate while talking about McLuhan. where can people find the book? Where can they find anything else, Nick, that you want to mention here at the end?
Sure. The book is published by Fortress Press. It's available online, all the major and usual places. My website is www.nickrapatrazone.com, and my writing, previous books are available there.
Wonderful. And again, the book is Digital Communion, Marshall McLuhan's Spiritual Vision for a Virtual Age. Nick, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you so much.